everyone, and welcome to another episode of Pulse. This week is part two of ethical journalism
and what it means to have journalism that truly captures the full idea of an issue at hand. For this, we're going to be looking into the scope of criminal legal reform, looking at how that is actually covered, and look at some of the biases in this coverage, especially in states such as the southernmost states that have a different lens when looking at criminal legal journalism. I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Michael.
Happy to be here.
And by Ginny Graham.
Hi, I'm Ginny Graham. I've worked at the Tulsa World for 28 years. For the last 5 years, I've worked in the opinions section. I'm currently the editorials editor. I've covered in that time a little bit of everything. But of the 28 years, I've been a columnist for about 10. I've certainly covered crime. And I think no matter what area of journalism you work in, it's something that you will end up writing about at some point. So, but that's who I am.
So in episode one, we really started to dive into what it looks like when a piece is trying to elicit an emotional response, when a piece might be skewing some data, how you can really start to break down some of this journalism that is not so ethical. But in this episode, we really want to start centering in Oklahoma. What are we seeing in reporting in Oklahoma? What issues are kind of coming up? Where can we give due praise? Where do we really need to be more wary when we're consuming this media? We really want to start breaking that down. And when we hop into the conversation here in a second, we're going to hop back in, starting with those misconceptions. That's not really the media's fault, if we want to be honest, but it's these misconceptions that have been brewed in especially southernmost states like Oklahoma for so long, and how that can lead to picking up stories and that can lead to misconceptions that reporters might not even be doing intentionally, but kind of looking at how these misconceptions are. So we're gonna hop back into the conversation there where we left it off, but let's get into it.
So this topic in general kind of reminds me of the first paper that I ever had to read for my degree. And it was actually published in 1984. It was like a 200-page paper, and it's Myths That Cause Crime. It's by Papinski and Jesselow, and it basically is the popular myths underlying U.S. crime control policies and how they're attacked, and the government efforts to control crime are often criticized as being too costly and misdirected. And the 10 myths that are debunked are: crime is increasing, most crime is committed by the poor, some groups are more law-abiding than others, white-collar crime is nonviolent, regulatory agencies prevent white-collar crime, rich and poor are equal before the law, drug addiction causes crime, community corrections is a viable alternative, the punishment can fit the crime, and finally, that law makes people behave. It goes on to say basically that the importance of the government concentrating not on law enforcement, but on action that strengthens American communities and makes them secure is emphasized. And American investment in the security and welfare of the general populace rather than the protection of wealthy vested interest is recommended. I mean, this was all the way back in 84, but the creation of three types of jobs is suggested. Basically, businesses in which the general populace can produce goods and services, businesses in which offenders can redeem themselves through legitimate production, and structures in which criminal justice officials can build ways of keeping peace in their communities without law enforcement. And although small businesses are notorious for failing, they have been the source of 70% of the growth in American employment in the last decade. And the risk must be weighted against the proven failure of conventional approaches to investment and social control. It's a fascinating look at what really happens when you break down some of these misconceptions. I mean, a misconception we're having right now is the difference in crime rates, in rates in general, since there has been a considerable uptick in murders, and that was something in 2020. So Mike, if you want to help us start to break that down, that misconception.
Yeah, there have been a lot of misconceptions about crime during the COVID pandemic. And as we get further and further away from that 2020 epicenter, and the more data we are seeing coming in, we are starting to understand exactly what was happening. But it can be very difficult to disentangle all of this. So the headline item is that crime in general went down during that 2020 time period. In the first month of the pandemic, when the COVID lockdowns were really in effect across the country, there was a roughly 23% drop in overall crimes in the nation's largest 25 cities. However, obviously, this varied across category, but in a manner that makes intuitive sense. So, for example, home burglaries dropped by roughly 24%, but there was an increase of around 38% of commercial burglaries, as more people were in homes and there were less eyes on commercial establishments. Drug crimes dropped an outstanding 65% during the pandemic, but this was likely more of an indication of selective law enforcement than a true decline in instances of crime. However, while crime declined during the pandemic, the rate of intentional homicide actually rose substantially by 30% from 2019 to 2020. That was the largest single year increase in more than 100 years. So we're talking about a substantial rise. However, it is also important to note that while this 30% increase is quite large, the overall intentional homicide rate is still lower than it was in the early 1990s by 22% and lower than it was in the late 1970s by nearly 30%. Meaning that even after this substantial rise in the US murder rate, it is still 71% lower than the drug overdose mortality rate. 7.8 people out of 100,000 are murdered, while 27.1 out of 100,000 will die of a drug overdose. And that's not to say that we shouldn't be concerned about the rise in intentional homicides, because I think we can all agree that one murder is likely too many. But it is important to separate and parse out these statistics, because while a 30% rise in intentional homicides is alarming, other forms of violent crime, including rape and robbery, actually declined over this period. And as I stated earlier, the overall crime rate actually dropped substantially. So the reasons for this spike in murders are unclear. There's been a long-held trend of consistent declines in murder rates, and this reversed much of those gains. Obviously, the pandemic had an effect both economically and psychologically on the population. And as I have discussed at length, the effects of economic distress on violent crime are substantial. For instance, a study in the United States using county-level data sets found that for every 1% increase in income inequality, there is a resulting 1.5% increase in assaults and a 1.3% increase in robberies. And this relationship was found to be true in both rural and the 200 most populous counties in the country. Another study found that an income inequality increase of 1% results in an increase of intentional homicides by 2.97%. And this result held true globally, regardless of latitude or hemisphere or governmental structure or geographical area. So 38% of the variation country to country in violent crime can be attributed directly, linearly, to income inequality. However, there were groups of countries with stronger and weaker correlations, and the United States is in the second highest correlation category, alongside countries such as Iran, Pakistan, Ethiopia, and Belarus. So obviously there's no way to know what exactly caused the rise in intentional homicides. And honestly, it is probably a multitude of factors. But when we're considering crime over the pandemic, it is important to also note that crime in general was down, and that included most categories of violent crime.
There's always been a battle between perception and reality. And I think all that plays in, but you know, I pitched one time and I did a story on the number of people. I think that Oklahoma has a huge number of people with life without parole. And because we, for people who didn't want to get into the death penalty, they thought, well, life without parole will be fine. But what we have, it's almost, when you think about it, I said, we have people that's almost more cruel than a death penalty, because we're talking about no matter what happens, we're never going to even let the people ask to be let out. And we have a huge number, and some of them, a good healthy number of them, aren't murderers. They're for other crimes, life without parole. And so, but to get that story, I had pushback even within my newsroom, like, well, do people really care? I mean, it's so I had, and I ended up doing the story, but it took me months to convince a couple of editors to let me do that. So You know, that's sometimes what you're up against. But when I showed them not only the data, but then I brought up some stories like, hey, you know, we have people in there who sold drugs like 30 years ago. And now they're, you know, they're basically elderly and we're still keeping them in for why, you know? And so again, you find that story, you have data and you can present it, but that's not going to be something that they're going to hear on broadcast news.
Yeah. So I'm glad you brought up the life without parole issue, because it's something that we at OCJR have been keeping our eyes on pretty closely. So the trends in Oklahoma and the country at large are moving in the opposite directions. So something is most definitely wrong. So what I mean by that is in the country, we see that over the past couple decades, homicides have fallen. Even death sentences have reached record lows. However, those sentenced to life without parole are at the highest rate we've ever seen. So homicides are down, death sentences are down, but life without parole is on the rise. The United States have never seen more than 4,000 individuals on death row, but as of 2020, there were only 2,700 people on death row. And yet still over 50,000 inmates across the country are serving life without parole sentences, and that number just keeps rising. This pattern holds true in Oklahoma as well, where as of today, around 1 in 8 prisoners is serving a life without parole sentence for a total of just under 3,000 individuals in our state. From 2003 to 2016, the percentage of prisoners who were on life without parole sentences grew by 42% in Oklahoma, compared to just 18% nationally, and only 6.1% in neighboring Texas, and 14.2% in Arkansas. 17% of these individuals that have life without parole sentences are African American, and you have to compare that to the state population, which is roughly 12%. And also 6% of people, of individuals on life without parole sentences are women. And that's compared to a national average of 3%. So that is double in Oklahoma. These long sentences with no release mechanism force the taxpayer to subsidize the medical expenses of the incarcerated individual. And these, you know, tend to generally rise as the individual ages. So these costs to the public are not offset by a reduction in crime. Life without parole permanently incapacitates an individual, right, by ensuring that they will not commit another crime. So that's one method of crime reduction. This method of crime reduction is faulty, of course, because it relies on the assumption that crime will continue to occur by that individual. But it's well known that people tend to age out of crime, and just a whole host of reasons that assumption may be incorrect. Criminal conduct peaks at age 17 and slowly decreases over time, meaning that Oklahoma is unnecessarily incarcerating people who are unlikely to reoffend because of their age and their sentence length, with no effect on the public safety. In other words, the criminal justice system relies on prior convictions to predict future criminality, and this is a highly over-inclusive method, meaning that Oklahoma is incarcerating false positives for an excess amount of time than is necessary. LWOP statutes, or life without parole statutes, vary among jurisdictions, and eligibility can depend on broad, vague, or complex criteria, and the likelihood that people know their own state's law is highly unlikely. This is especially true of those who may receive life without parole for a nonviolent crime due to a habitual offender statute. Potential offenders cannot be deterred from an action if they truly are not aware of the consequences.
I just quickly want to harp on that part that you said about the sentences being different in different counties. I think that is so important. And that was what 1646 was supposed to do. That felony reclassification bill was supposed to fix issues like this, where some people are getting LWOP, some people are getting a couple months, some people are, you never know, it's different between all these counties, and that's such an issue. I mean, just, you can't even say that that's not a miscarriage of justice, that that's not unfair. If I remember correctly, there's been two U.S. Supreme Court decisions and then subsequent state appellate court rulings that have basically held that most people serving life without parole for crimes committed before they were 18 years old in Oklahoma are entitled to new sentence hearings that take their youth and their potential for rehabilitation into account. But from what I understand, there's been a huge issue with actually finding attorneys who will take on these cases and kind of starting this long process for many people. Actually, in 2020, the last thing that I remember about this, in 2020, Representative Virgin and Senator Young actually put up legislation that would have made it, you would not have been able to charge juveniles with life without parole anymore. And it didn't pass, but I do agree with Mike, there's this changing narrative and this changing sentiment towards certain things such as that.
One of the things that is interesting in Oklahoma that I found, because Oklahoma has incarcerated so many people for so long, that more people appear to be open for that type of change because so many people are affected by it, that even the most conservative, you know, pro-police, pro-law enforcement, they're willing to listen to bail reform. They're willing to listen to the notion of putting money into PAC teams for mental health, people in crisis, because so many people are personally affected by it. I think there is more ground for us to find together across political spectrums. And that gives me hope and optimism that the criminal justice movement in Oklahoma can make some strides, because so many people have been affected by it. And they've seen how things maybe aren't fair or could be better, or their loved ones have gotten lost in the system. So I think even though there's this, you know, national anger and fear of crime, I think at the local levels where we're at, I think there are more people who are willing to listen and change and find something that helps individuals, because certainly our status quo is not working.
Another theory other than the cultivation theory is the social diffusion theory, where people think that fear of crime is greater because, like you've heard, your cousin's guy was a victim and that just is diffused through social networks. But what you're describing is actually the opposite, where I guess compassion for those formerly incarcerated is diffusing socially. So that's a very interesting and good sentiment.
Well, and a lot of churches have sort of embraced this notion too. So I've come across people who, again, they're going to watch Fox and they're going to buy into all that, but their church does a prison ministry. And so they know someone and they're going to help that person. So their view may be on this particular issue more progressive than other issues. And it is an interesting sort of dichotomy on that, but like I say, I think that Oklahoma, we've just incarcerated so many people that people are looking at it differently. But there's still, again, we're moving into a political season and we're already seeing the ads of soft on crime, because people in theory don't want to be soft on crime, but I've always called it the power of one on any issue. And it came from Anna Quinlan of all people. But I think as people meet others who are formerly incarcerated, or meet people who, you know, have a substance abuse problem and have been in and out and they're good people, I think as we meet each other, then the compassion grows. You know, no matter what your political stripe is, it's harder to be mad at the PTA mom who's turned her life around and trying her best. It's harder to be mad at that worker who you hired, taking a chance, and it's your best worker and you want to help more people like it. So I think that it's the power of one. You meet one, you meet another, and then you start seeing a different side of things. And right now, Oklahoma, there's a lot of people that are living in our communities that have been in prison. And I think what we need to focus on now is trying to make our communities better as people come out, because that's been the missing part of the equation. We have 780 in place that keeps people from prison or releases people, but if we don't bolster mental health programs, job training programs, make, you know, GEDs and college available trade schools. People are just going to be released in the communities that they've always had. So we need, to me, that's where, and I know that you, for you in your group, that's what you're focused on. I think you're reaching more people than you think who want to help with those programs as well. And so I think it's a little, maybe a little different here. Again, maybe I'm optimistic and being hopeful, but I just think that there people are more willing to see change here because frankly, our prison budget is breaking the bank. We cannot afford this kind of corrections budget. And Kevin Stitt has, I mean, he's closed a couple of private prisons. He's released people. I mean, he's making some effort on that, but we just need significantly more. And we need to get the funding for 781 into the counties so they can improve those programs. But Oklahoma, we don't have a whole lot of money to begin with. We certainly don't need to be spending it on locking up people we're mad at. So I think people can agree on that area.
So the history of DOC budget and the prison system is actually so interesting. At statehood, Oklahoma actually didn't have its own prison system, and so inmates were being sent to Kansas. But then Kay Barnard, our first commissioner of charities and corrections, she actually found out that those prisoners were being treated horrifically in Kansas. And so she therefore started to work to establish the construction of the state's first prison and the establishment of a three-tiered state prison system, which used to include a penitentiary, a reformatory, and a boys' training school. And now, obviously, DOC looks very different, and it's also one of the top 12 agencies in terms of state-appropriated dollars, the fifth highest agency, in fact. And unlike some other agencies, the greatest sources of their funding is 91% comes from taxpayer dollars. The remaining 9% comes from revolving funds within DOC, like Canteen Revolving Fund or the Prison Industries Fund. But Oklahoma incarcerates inmates in 16 state prisons, 2 private prisons, 7 community correction centers, 2 contracted halfway houses, and 1 contracted county jail. In the fiscal year of 2020, DOC's total budget was $613 million, which was a 9.9% increase than their previous budget of $558 million. And then, after low energy prices and the pandemic, since our state's revenue took quite a hit, the fiscal year of 2021, DOC's appropriation is $531 million. But outside of that, there's more than that. Additionally, this past legislative session, we increased our per diem that is going to be given to private prisons. This funding is astronomical. And then it leads us to another issue, State Question 780, 781. These areas in which there are funds, there are increases in the funding, but we're not seeing that being appropriately given to the community and appropriately designated.
It's been a long time and not a dime has been put toward it. And it's wrong. It's illegal, I would argue. And it's against what the voters wanted. The legislature hasn't done its job. I have written on this. I could go off on that, but it's like the counties are owed a minimum of $50 million right now. And it's based on population. And if they had the money that they are owed by law, by what the voters approved, then our communities would start to offer programs to help people being released. And the cynical part of me, which I try not to let out, but it is out there. There's a thought that there are some lawmakers who were always against it, who didn't want it, that they're trying to starve out the success. That, okay, fine, we passed 780, but look, it's failed. Look at all the reoffenders. Look at all this. Well, if you're not going to reinvest what you're supposed to, then you're not, the program is not fully functioning right now. It's like, you know, cutting money to education and then saying, gosh, the schools are failing. It's like, well, if you're not going to invest in what will work, then you can't really call it a failure. So there's a thought out there that by not funding 781 like they're supposed to, that it's purposely trying to make that effort fail. And look, we should be looking all locking up all these people.
Right. You're not actually giving it a fair shot. You know, right. You're saying you did, but at the end of the day, did you really give it a fair shot? And we see this in the reporting as well. So
recently an article misrepresented the claim that public safety is in question due to state question 780. And they basically, this reform, to expound on it a little bit more, recategorized low-level drug and property crimes from felonies to misdemeanors. And therefore it allowed more individuals to be diverted and they were able to be punishable by fines or jail days instead of prison time. And basically the premise of this was just to treat addiction as a health condition and allow individuals who battle an addiction to be treated like patients instead of prisoners. And even today it has a 76% voter approval, and the reform is estimated to have saved taxpayers an estimated $10 million every single year since it's been passed.
Right.
And so this article came out and it stated that of the 500 people who received the mass commutation in November of 2019, which was the largest commutation in the history of the nation, actually, the article states that over half of those individuals were rearrested. But then you go on, and when you really dig into this data, that's not what you should be looking at. What it should have said is that only 23 individuals ended up being sentenced to serve additional time. That's 4%. Or that's an eighth of the national return to prison rate of 32% within 2 years. That's an incredible number. And but that doesn't promote the false narrative of it being not successful, because 780 has been wildly successful. But as we just stated, it can't be a band-aid to place on a huge system that's got, you know, a boat that's sinking with holes everywhere and water coming in. Slapping one little band-aid on it isn't going to fix it. And arrests are a terrible measure of recidivism. They don't capture the behavior. They capture policing patterns, socioeconomic status, and the proximity to the system involvement, basically.
Yeah, you hit on the two questions I had. That was a story written by the Oklahoman, and we ran it too. But yes, I walked away from it with two basic questions, which was how many of those arrests led to a charge and conviction? Because some of them just may not have even been charged. They could have been arrested and released. I mean, you just never know. And then the second one was, well, it didn't surprise me, because if we haven't funded 781 said money saved from the prisons is supposed to go to the counties, and then the counties can invest it however they need. I'm sure Tulsa County would love to have something down at the jail, because we have, our sheriff has been talking for a long time that he's basically running a mental health facility and that they're not prepared for that. They need more. So between that and other needs, we can help people avoid prison. And there may be counties where maybe the issue is something completely different, but the local level can decide for their communities how best to bolster the programs to prevent incarceration. So if we don't have that funded, then they're just returning to the same old thing. They're returning to the same neighborhoods, the same, you know, there's nothing more for them to get help. So those are the two big questions and the two big things left out of that story. And I think those are fair criticisms. And I did not know that statistic you mentioned. So I'm going to encourage you to write an op-ed or somehow get that information out there, because it needs to be out there that only 4% were charged in the 23.
Yeah, I also want to note that even while they were focusing on arrests, the rearrest rate cited in that article is actually still slightly lower than the national rearrest rate as reported by the Bureau of Justice Statistics. So the return to prison rate is lower than the national averages, which tells us that most of these rearrests were not substantiated or serious. There's overwhelming evidence that supports the successes of State Question 780. That data was not considered in the article. For instance, from 2017 to 2020, property crimes declined by 6.34%, including 6.93% in Tulsa. Robbery has declined 25% statewide. Violent crime in general has declined 5.8% in Oklahoma City and 34.5% in Tulsa County. Violent crime in the state as a whole has declined by 3.4% from 2018 to 2020. And this is compared to a national violent crime rate that rose 1% since 2017.
It is interesting. You know, I don't know. You know, you talk about people being angry. I think there's something about people being fearful too. That I don't know if there's psychology behind that or not, but I do think that journalists do have a responsibility to give that whole picture. And so that's why I'm glad that you guys are out there doing that kind of work. There aren't as many journalists as there used to be. I mean, to be perfectly honest, I think the other day I came across a statistic that said there were something like 7 PR people for every journalist in America, because organizations have just cut out journalists. And so I think I'm seeing work out of nonprofits like your group, other groups are sort of picking up that mantle and being able to dig into data a little more and present it. Like I say, I think that we still need to look at what that data is, where it comes from, and if it's skewed. But I do see the work that you guys are doing as being really important to furthering some of these causes that are improving our community. Those are interesting numbers.
Authenticity and education is something that's really important to us. I found as a younger person coming into reform, coming into the nonprofit sphere, it was super daunting to have so much to learn and so much to kind of jump into. So we definitely try to make it as easy as possible for people to jump right in. I was sitting here thinking when we were kind of talking about public opinion and fear, I don't know. I think it's the show Cops. Wasn't it Cops that did like 9 seasons in Tulsa or in Oklahoma or something?
I don't know if it was Cops. It's eluding me, but yes, it was. And we editorialized against it. But again, it kind of shows that divide. The defense of it from the city, you know, the mayor and everybody said, well, it really shows what the cops are up against every day. But it doesn't. It didn't. What it did is that, and we argued the same that you did, which is it shows people on their worst day. It really doesn't show what cops are up against each day. I mean, the cops I know and friends with, there's some downtime. There's some riding around. But what they're doing is they're picking the high points. They're hyping up things. And while I do think cops face some really challenging scenarios that deal with people in mental health crisis, with decisions have to be made, that wasn't showing that. You know, they were just trying to find, you know, people in a mental health crisis and portraying them as like, oh, that crazy person in Tulsa or that crazy person in Richmond. And it was just unfair. And it was also showing certain parts of town where, you know, they weren't in South Tulsa. Yeah, those programs, and those were really popular programs. But it was defended, and people who watched it said, well, we just like seeing what cops are doing. Well, we want to see that side. Well, you're not seeing the other side of the families of that person who've been trying to get a person mental health treatment for years and off the street. You're not seeing, you know, another side of struggle. So again, we disagreed with the police department and the city on that editorially, but that's just sort of the culture we're in. But I kind of wonder if that's changing a little bit. Like I say, more and more people in Oklahoma are affected by mental health problems and being arrested. You're not going to have it overnight. But the fact that we did in that contract, they ended up canceling the program overall, I think, because of national pushback. Because I think...
Yeah, I did a quick search. It was Live PD.
That's it, Live PD. Yeah.
Yes.
I never watched it, but I had friends that were like, loved it.
Oh my gosh.
They were like,
avid.
Yeah, they just loved it. And I said, well, but you could have gotten that through just some sort of, but they also love The Wire. I'm like, you could get that same thing through, you know, other media. But I just felt like I felt it was unfair. And I think it's because maybe I just covered more. And that's the other thing. We're coming at it from a view of having known these people. These aren't theoretical people. I know families and done stories on families who have been trying to get people, you know, they're just in a different reality and they're on the streets and there's a real difficulty we're facing on what to do with this very small subset of people. And they were just sort of filming it as under the guise of look what police deal with. And I think police deal with some serious things. I think we can portray that differently and more authentically than in an entertainment program. And that's what we were getting at, is if that's the goal, then we can still do things that show what police are up against and also be respectful of people who are on their worst day.
Right. Because actually all 3 of those shows that when we were trying to come up with it, actually all of those have been filmed in Tulsa. So when I was looking this up, Cops did over 4 seasons. The first 48
has done 9 seasons, and then all of the seasons of Live PD or PD Cam were in Tulsa as well, because like we alluded to, the host was Sergeant Sean Larkin. They call him Sticks of the Tulsa Police Department. And he was a part of the gang unit whenever he was in the Tulsa Police Department. He's got a new lens now. Yes, he's from Oklahoma. And yes, we will always support our own. That is just Oklahoma. But we still need to take it with that grain of salt, you know? And shows like that, that are reaching even broader and broader audiences, matters as well, because that's how people are viewing us. And when we talk about what our cops are going through, I think we also want to be respectful to our cops. We want to show the good work that they're doing as well. They're not just constantly policing. They're not just doing that. Like, why can't we have something? We did an interview with a police officer, and he spoke about, it was actually the chief of a department, and he spoke about all of the community events that they do. They do stuff for 4th of July. They do stuff for Coffee with a Cop Day. They had a list of about 50 events that these cops do to give back to the community. And you don't see that when you have these shows about policing and, you know, catching individuals and the chases and all of that. I think it's good that we also begin to humanize cops as well. They're not just adrenaline junkies, you know, always out for the chase. They care about the community as well, and they're investing in it too. And shows like that don't show that. They don't show the best side of anyone.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I've been very frustrated by the division of, you know, pro cop, anti cop, back the blue, not back the blue. I'm like, a lot of us are right in the middle. I mean, I absolutely want a strong police force, but the cops for years have been talking about how so much of what they deal with are things they shouldn't deal with. I mean, for years, we task our police officers to basically give rides for people in crisis to hospitals in other places. We would be, and they would be on overtime. They would be away from their job, that they needed transport. We did not have transport in Oklahoma for people in a mental health crisis. And so that was our cops. Well, that shouldn't have been their job. We needed to have a mental health system that would provide transport from one hospital to another. And so we have that now, but those are the kind of things that, you know, it all plays into politics and not necessarily good policy.
Right. We always say that you have to set the police up for success. Some of the areas right now is just, they don't even have the resources. They don't have the education to deal with some of these situations that we're throwing them into. And so you can back them by wanting them to be safer, by wanting them to not be a catch-all for every single case of someone in crisis. Right, they can't be a catch-all for every single thing that's happening in Oklahoma, because it's A, leading to mass incarceration, and B, it's putting them in harm's way, and it's putting the individual in crisis in harm's way. It's just not safe for our community. So you can back them firmly by wanting them to have checks and balances, by wanting to give them the right resources so that they can best do their job safely and still protect the community as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. And exactly. I mean, we're on the same page on that.
It's easy, especially whenever you come from that stance of you just want the best. Like we've just been talking about at the end, you just want people to know the truth. You want them to be educated. You want them to be able to make their own decisions, all of that. It's easy to get amped up as well. And we are all, both groups for the Postal World and for OCJR, just really passionate about making sure that people have all the information in front of them.
I would encourage people, certainly in our paper, we're accessible. It markets the size of Tulsa. You can get a hold of the reporter, even on broadcast. If you hear or see something that you're like, that doesn't sound right, or that's incomplete, you can usually find that person. You know, look online, call the newsroom. I know that for us, our emails for all the reporters and all the writers are with our, at the end of our stories. Contact them and say, you know, don't be angry, because no one responds to anger, but say, you know, this is an issue I'm concerned with, and here's what I noticed, the word you use or the data that you used, and talk to the reporter about it. And for us with the newspaper, one of the outlets we have, and it's the section I work in, which is the opinion section. And I'm always open for, we have letters to the editor that anyone can submit a letter. You can submit it online, tulsaworld.com. in the / opinion, and you'll see a submit letter, but also for people who are experts in the field, frontline workers, researchers, I'm always looking for op-eds, which are basically guest columns. And so I would encourage people to, you know, contact me and say, you know, here's, I want to write a different perspective on this issue, or I want to, you know, here's some new information that I'd like to get out. So engage with the media that's out there, because we can't report and we can't write about what we don't know. And so I learned some things on this podcast that I'm going to go back and say, hey, here are some things we ought to be looking at, because it just didn't, you know, come across our desk. In whatever issue you're working on, with This Is Criminal Justice, you know, just be in touch. Just, you know, don't be afraid to contact and call and engage with the people who are covering this, because we do want to know both sides. But again, we can't present it if we don't know it.
Yeah, I would just like to thank Jenny for being here. This was a really interesting and fulfilling discussion, I think. I'm just thankful that she came on and talked to us.
Oh, in any time. And I'm sure there are probably questions about, like, you know, we didn't even get into, like, you know, a lot of the language that you've seen, those kind of things. But I appreciate that you guys are out there working on this, because we need passionate people, smart people working on these issues. And you come at it with a, you have passion, but you want to do the right thing based on the correct information and not just a hunch or a politicized angle. And that's very important. So keep at it. We need people like you guys to help our state become better.
Now, whenever you read an article yourself as a viewer, you can be like, okay, I see, you know, maybe we're eliciting an emotional response here. Thank you again to Jenny, and thank you, Michael. And with that, we hope that you watch our other episodes, and we hope to see you back next week.